Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the criminal trial of Donald Trump underway in New York and examine the prologue to the trial going back to the case brought by the Republican Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney at the time, Jeffrey Berman, which resulted in Michael Cohen going to jail while Individual One got off, even though the hush money payment to the porn star was for Trump's benefit and made at his direction. Joining us to discuss how Attorney General Barr tried to shut down Berman's further investigation into the matter, ending with Berman being fired, is Rebecca Roiffe, a professor of law at New York Law School who studies ethics and history. She was previously assistant district attorney in Manhattan, and her work examines the country's tradition of prosecutorial independence, particularly with regard to the president's power to control the Department of Justice. Then we'll look into whether Speaker Mike Johnson is serious about getting aid to Ukraine, given how much Israel is a Republican priority and how little time there is to vote on a separate Ukraine bill before the next recess. Joining us is Anders Aslan, a senior fellow at the Stockholm Free World Forum, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a former member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It, and Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. We'll discuss his article at the Kyiv Post, Ukraine Should Not Be Left to the Mercy of Devious U.S. Politicians. Then finally, we'll assess Biden's tax plan announced on Tax Day, which highlights the social values of America's middle class in contrast to the billionaires Trump helps out with his tax cuts, who pay lower taxes than average folks. Joining us is Chuck Ma, the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 to 2004, he was Economic Policy Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and Senior Advisor for Budget Policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton. We'll discuss his new report at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities for Tax Day, Seven Charts on the 2017 Trump Tax Law, and why Congress should set a new course. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Rebecca Roiffe, who's a professor of law at New York Law School, who studies ethics and history. She was previously assistant district attorney in Manhattan, and her work examines the country's tradition of prosecutorial independence, particularly with regard to the president's power to control the Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Roiffe.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's so much attention to the trial now going on in Manhattan of Donald Trump, the first criminal trial, of course, understandably so. But there's very little coverage of what the prologue or to this trial is. And that goes back to the trial of Michael Cohen when he was convicted by the U.S. attorney in New York, former U.S. attorney, Republican Jeffrey Berman. And in that case, of course, there was a reference to individual number one, and everybody understood to be Donald Trump. And at the time, it always seemed a little odd that Michael Cohen should go to jail for paying off a porn star, laundering the money through his account for the benefit of individual one being Donald Trump. And apparently there's a whole backstory which Jeffrey Berman wrote about in a book that he published after called Holding the Line. So why is there little attention? I have to give Rachel Maddow credit for doing it on MSNBC recently, but this seems to me to be an incredibly important prologue.
Absolutely. I mean, we very rarely have a glimpse into what happens in the background of these sorts of decisions. And this is one of those few times in which we actually have some information about what went into the decision making. So I think it is an important piece of news.
So can we sort of go through it a little? Were you at the Manhattan DA's at the time?
At the time at which this decision was made?
Yeah. When
So it was made, this was the U.S. Attorney's office, and no, sure. I wasn't at that office, yeah.
I understand. But you were clearly following it at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what happened then is that Bill Barr intervened on the part of Trump to bury any reference to Individual One and put enormous pressure on Berman to the point of even announcing publicly that he was being fired. He fought back, and I guess as a compromise, he finally was able to at least have somebody succeed him that wasn't completely under the control of Bill Barr. Is that your recollection?
Right. So there was a lot of pressure in a number of cases, as I understand, or that's Jeffrey Berman's account. And ultimately, he was asked to step down and pushed back, but then did step down once he was assured that there would be somebody competent and experienced to take his place.
And Bill Barr had succeeded in putting his person in at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, which is an extremely important post. He'd managed to ease out the U.S. Attorney there and put in his favored U.S. Attorney, who then gave a massive break to Michael Flynn, the disgraced former National Security Advisor, who had already pled guilty. They undid the guilty plea, and they also helped out Roger Stone, who was also facing jail time.
Yeah, so Bill Barr had a very unique view of his power within the Department of Justice that I think is different from some of the other attorneys general who preceded him. He really felt that centralized control was important and was necessary. And, you know, it isn't clear that is not allowed in a legal way, but it does go against some norms where there are certain aspects of independence that are usually respected by the attorney generals, even though they're not required to do so.
But it seems that Bill Barr was basically going out of his way to protect Trump, both by getting Michael Flynn off the hook, also Roger Stone, and more importantly, in the case of New York, pressuring Berman not to mention anything about Trump while Michael Cohen is doing time helping out Trump with the porn star.
It certainly does look that way. And, you know, while Bill Barr insisted, and, you know, at various different points in his tenure that the department was independent of presidential control, he nonetheless did a number of things that benefited and in some ways seemed to be the bidding of the president. In fact, he sometimes complained about President Trump's vocal positions on individual prosecutions because it made it harder for Bill Barr to intervene in those without it making it look like he was simply doing the president's bidding.
So what was he doing, though, in terms of Individual One? Because that apparently was the first thing that Barr tried to change. You know, just don't even mention the possibility of Individual One, let alone who Individual One was.
Right. I mean, it isn't unprecedented to have unnamed individuals. We actually saw it in the indictment in the January 6th case, where rather than name the co-conspirators, there's co-conspirator one, co-conspirator two, and the public has and the media has done a good job of speculating, probably accurately, about who those individuals are. But it is a technique that prosecutors sometimes use. Now, what the interaction is between the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney in terms of their preference and how to do this is a different matter. So, you know, whether they used the term Individual One and whether they made charging decisions based on instructions or orders from the Attorney General, that's a different matter from just simply using that term because they weren't ready or hadn't yet indicted another person.
But in his book, Holding the Line, former U.S. attorney at the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, mm-hmm. not only did he talk about how the pressure that Barr put on him, not to mention Trump, and he said he held the line, and of course, as he eventually had to step down, and the compromise was mm-hmm. at least his successor is not going to be somebody that Barr handpicked. But he did say that he also got pressure from Trump one day after Trump issued tweets attacking Kerry over the Iran nuclear deal to mm-hmm. prosecute John Kerry, and also an attorney, right, Craig, who they did go ahead and try and try him, even though there wasn't a case. And Greg Craig's case was thrown out pretty quickly by the jury, mm-hmm. but at least it seems like Berman buckled there and had to go ahead with a prosecution that he knew was, I don't know whether it was phony, but it was at least ill-advised.
Did that prosecution come out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District? I think it was the Durham prosecution from Connecticut, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think the problem with Durham was that he was handpicked from Barr as somebody who would do his bidding, and Barr was very much involved in that investigation and the ultimate decision.
Right. I think they also shouted other cases to the other district in New York, didn't they?
Right. So, I mean, you know, handpicking and choosing is, again, something that is contrary to the norms of that office. Normally, there are investigations that are conducted within certain offices. And when something comes out of Central Department of Justice, they farm it out to the most, you know, the office that has the greatest venue, the most connection to wherever these events occurred. They don't handpick based on which U.S. attorney is the most compliant or agreeable in terms of their politics and ideology. That's completely inappropriate.
So how significant then is all of this backstory that we're talking about? I mean, it feels like the sort of circle has now turned, right? Even though it's not a federal case, it's a state case, which is sort of shoehorning in federal laws about election law, although states also control elections as well. How do you see it in the context of what we're talking about in terms of the history here, starting with Michael Cohen being convicted and going to jail?
Right. Doing
what Trump basically was bidding.
Right. I mean, one thing is that, you know, I've heard a number of people suggest, including the former president himself, that the delay here implies that there's some kind of inappropriate conduct on the part of the Manhattan District Attorney. And the fact that the president wasn't named or charged by the Southern District of New York somehow casts a shadow over the Manhattan District Attorney's case. And I think that's incorrect, in part because of the issues that you raise, that, you know, the decisions that the Southern District were making were constrained. And we know from Jeffrey Berman that they were partially constrained by instructions he was getting from Bill Barr, who is officially his boss. And they were also constrained by the fact that, as we know, you cannot prosecute a sitting president. And so there are all sorts of, not to mention the fact that the federal government has different criminal laws than the state government. So the relevance of that decision to the Manhattan District Attorney's decision is virtually none. And the fact that he wasn't charged in that case should not in any way suggest that he is not involved in the underlying conduct that has led to the charges in Manhattan.
So how solid is the ground that he's on then, given that the predictably Trump and his attorneys will attack that idea that he's shoehorning a federal case in a state case and bringing up Pomerantz and all of the back and forth and having...
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a couple of things about that. First of all, the things that he says in public and that his proxies say in the media are not all things that are going to be admissible in court. And so there's that issue that, you know, court is really a curated experience in order to make the proceedings fair for both sides. And of course, in our system, we do favor criminal defendants in certain ways, in part because of the, you know, burden of proof being on the government. But there are still limitations on what you're allowed to bring up. And if it's not relevant, you're not allowed to bring it up. So there's some things that just won't come into the proceedings at all. To the extent that there are relevant pieces of this puzzle, namely, I think there are important pieces about Michael Cohen's credibility accountability. Those will certainly be brought up, but the how important they are to this case, I really wonder, because I think mostly this case is going to be a documents case. And most of the things that Michael Cohen's going to say, 99% of them, I mean, I don't know if quite that much, but certainly a large percent are going to be corroborated by these documents. Not only that, but there is also a kind of common sense understanding. Like, why else would you be going to all these measures to play around with your internal records if not for the fact that you're trying to commit another crime? And of course, there are complications with the legal argument. There always are. But I think these are relatively small matters when it comes to this case in New York.
But are the prosecution going to put Jeffrey Berman on the stand? Is there any talk about that?
I haven't heard it. And I would think, again, you know, what he has to say is not relevant here, because what happened in a different jurisdiction, which has deals with a different set of laws under a different prosecutor who was being pressured by the attorney general, really has so little to bear on the fact that the Manhattan DA, an elected official in our city, is seeking to enforce the laws of New York. These are just two entirely different issues. Now, it's not to say the significant overlap in facts is, you know, will certainly, you know, come up, and so in that way it's relevant. But I can't think of what relevant information, evidence that Jeffrey Berman would have to give in this case.
So one of the disparities, though, is whether the judge, of course, has put a gag order on Trump, and he pushes the envelope as much as he can. But I don't understand why it is that Trump is allowed to go on the courthouse steps and put out his version of what happened every day, where there's no such pushback from Alvin Bragg, for example. So Trump seems to be able to, even if he's restrained within the courtroom itself,
right,
as soon as he gets outside, he's able to sprout all kinds of nonsense, and nobody is there to challenge him.
Yeah.
What explains that disparity?
I mean, this is a disparity that's sort of built into our system. And as I said, there are ways in which prosecutors operate with their hands behind their back. I mean, there are certain ways in which they're incredibly powerful people. And because they have the power to take away somebody's liberty, we don't take that lightly. And so prosecutors really generally speak in the courtroom and through court documents. And, you know, defendants have a greater leeway. And that's in part because of the presumption of innocence. But of course, the gag order has put some limitations. Defendants don't have infinite First Amendment rights. They are not allowed to say things that will interfere with the fairness and integrity of the proceedings. And they are, of course, not allowed to say things that directly would lead to harm to a juror or a witness. And so gag orders are generally written very narrowly to address those interests so as not to interfere with First Amendment speech. And of course, the First Amendment speech issues here are more critical because it's core political speech that we're talking about, because this is overlapping with a presidential campaign. And so the judge is being very careful not to do anything or to do the minimum amount to protect the integrity of the proceedings without further interfering with a presidential, you know, with in some ways making it so that Donald Trump couldn't campaign in the way that he wants to campaign in a political election. And so that's the line that the judge is trying to follow. But yes, the disparity is true in every criminal case. So just defendants have more leeway to speak than prosecutors do.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Rebecca, this case, of course, is often or always referred to as the hush money case, but it's really about election interference. And does the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, have something up his sleeve in terms of election interference? Because that makes it a felony, right?
Well, it's the intent to commit another crime that makes it a felony. So, I always say about this case, it's a business records case. I mean, and which sounds dull, but in fact, Manhattan has a really strong interest in preserving the integrity of the financial markets. We are the center of the financial world, and this is an incredibly important law that is designed to make sure that powerful people don't use their businesses as a way to escape accountability. So, I think it's really that. But yes, in order to prove that it's a felony, he has to prove that Donald Trump's intent wasn't just to pull one over on people to kind of protect the reputation of his wife or something like that, but rather to commit another crime. And the other crimes that the prosecutor is suggesting that Donald Trump was trying to commit or cover up are those election violations and potentially tax fraud.
But these are crimes, federal crimes, that Trump has not been tried for, and that doesn't matter?
Because it's not the crime that he's being charged with. It's the intent that he's being charged with. So in every case, there's some mens rea, some mental state that a defendant has to be proved to have had. And so it's just the mental state. It's just an element of the state crime, not a different crime.
And you think that's strong enough, both legally and more importantly, I guess, for the public, because Trump keeps saying it's all a witch hunt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you never know until after a trial when all the evidence is out there. But from what we've seen reported publicly and from my understanding of these laws and how they work in Manhattan, I think it's a fairly strong case, in part because, as I said before, it's just hard to imagine that juries use common sense. And all that the prosecutor has to prove is that he wasn't just, you know, for the hell of it, excuse my language, for the heck of it, fiddling around with his business records, that he was doing it to commit or conceal another crime. And that, you know, is certainly a burden, but it doesn't seem like an insurmountable one.
Well, Rebecca Roifey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Roifey, who's a professor of law at New York Law School, who studies ethics and history. She was previously assistant district attorney in Manhattan, and her work examines the country's tradition of prosecutorial independence, particularly with regard to the president's power to control the Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether Speaker Mike Johnson is serious about getting aid to Ukraine, given how much Israel is a Republican priority and how little time there is to vote on a separate Ukraine bill before the next recess. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, a senior fellow at the Stockholm Free World Forum and a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It, and Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. And he has an article at the Kyiv Post, Ukraine Should Not Be Left to the Mercy of Devious U.S. Politicians. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
So when we talk about devious U.S. politicians, it turns out that there's just one U.S. politician that's essentially holding up Ukraine aid by blackmailing the new speaker, and that is Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I don't know whether she's devious. I mean, she's incredibly stupid, ignorant, dangerous, ill-informed, completely consumed by ridiculous conspiracy theories, but is she also on the Russian payroll?
I think that she's completely obedient to Donald Trump. What I hear from people who knew her, I don't, is that she's not as dumb as she sounds, but that she's working for a certain purpose. So as I understand it now, we have a very weak, but rather devious and clever Speaker Mike Johnson, and he doesn't really care about anything apart from one thing, that he stays Speaker. And how can he stay Speaker? First of all, he has to be loyal to the former President Donald Trump. Secondly, he must make sure that none of the other people attack him. So, I mean, the GOP extremists. So what he did now, on Friday, Mike Johnson went to Trump and said that they agree to 100% on Ukraine support. And Trump was much vaguer than he usually is. He was not coming out fully against it, but said that nothing must be done apart from on a credit, which makes no sense. And then he also made a comment on Marjorie Taylor Greene and said that she's a good friend after Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed a proposition to oust, that is, vacate Mike Johnson as Speaker. So as I read it, either you, Mike Johnson, do make sure that there is no money going to Ukraine, or I have my loyalist, Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's enough with one person, oust you. And this is really what we are talking about, which is completely absurd way of functioning. That one person out of 435 members of the House of Representatives can decide what will happen. But Trump has skillfully ended up in this situation. We must raise our hat and say he knows what he's doing. I'm not sure that the Biden administration does.
So just to try and recap, you're saying that, and it's obvious, that Trump is running the show here. He controls both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Mike Johnson. And that at the end of the day, it's Trump who doesn't want to give money to Ukraine because, what, he's taking orders from Putin?
That's what I understand. It's, Trump has not said any negative word about Putin. We know from Craig Unger's wonderful book, The House of Trump, The House of Putin, that Trump has made lots of money on the wealthy Russians, not necessarily corruption, but he has had made tens of millions of dollars on payments for his apartments from Russians, and he has been there since 1987 with very good connections. So Trump's connections with the high levels in Moscow are very good. And that, of course, arouses a suspicion. And Robert Mueller was not allowed by the Department of Justice to investigate Trump's financial connections with Russia. So we don't know anything in the criminal area, and FBI has not done anything. This is what I consider the most important issue of national security defense today, and that is not being done.
So what's going on then with Mike Johnson's saying he split this up into four bills: Israel, Ukraine, Indo-Pacific, and a bunch of other stuff that they want to do, which God knows what that is. So there's a couple of serious members of the Republican caucus, chairs of both the Intel Committee and Foreign Affairs, both of whom have said that members of their conference are basically parroting Russian propaganda, and it looks as if Johnson at least has to take them seriously. So what's going on? Is his Ukraine package a joke, or is it serious? I mean, in other words, is he defying Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene by even putting this package forward?
I think that the right word is devious. Mike Johnson said late on Monday, this is an important issue, so we have to discuss it for 72 hours. That means that no decision can be made until Friday. And after Friday, the House of Representatives goes on its well-deserved 2 weeks of holidays, which they normally take after they have achieved nothing. So Mike Johnson, in this fashion, managed on the one hand to show that he's open-minded, which he's not, and secondly, that it's only one day of opportunity, which is very short, and then we don't know what can be done, because the House of Representatives is chronically unpredictable. So my suspicion is that a few bills will go through, but not the Ukraine bill. So my suspicion is that the other bills will get through, perhaps with some amendment, but no money for Ukraine. And the big threat to Mike Johnson for the last couple of weeks has been that there will be a petition charge. And but that requires that people know what is up to happen. It takes some time to gather, is it 218 members? That is all of Democrats and a handful of Republicans who need to sign up. And probably the Republicans are not prepared to do that. What we are talking about here is a very prominent, good, highly respected Republican chairs, Mike McCall, Mike Turner, and Mike Roger. These are the three key people that you alluded to. And they will not know how to act until it's too late. And then the show is over. Mike Johnson has won. That's what I suspect.
So they'll push through the Israeli package, and they'll delay the Ukraine package till Friday and be too late to vote on it, and then they go away for 2 weeks. So that's the game, right? And that he's just pretending, Johnson is pretending to placate the Mikes, the chairs of these Intel, Foreign Affairs, etc., who are your old-style Republicans who aren't the new crazy MAGA types. So this, again, is playing right into Putin's hands, right? And he's also doing well on the battlefield in Ukraine. And the reason that they lost 10% of their electricity was that they didn't have the anti-aircraft missiles, the Patriot batteries, etc. They run out of ammunition. Needless to say, Israel gets protected, as they did in the last few days with hundreds of Iranian ballistic missiles shot down with U.S. Patriot batteries in Jordan and in Iraq. So there you have it, right? The same thing with what's happening in the House. Israel gets taken care of, but not Ukraine.
Indeed, and let me elaborate a little bit on this. So first, we now know that Kamala Harris met with Zelensky at the Munich Security Forum in February, and she had one big message. Don't bomb Russian oil refineries, because that will boost the oil prices in Russia. And President Zelensky rightly got quite, I shouldn't say furious, but very upset about it. And then we have seen one public official after the other. Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State, Julian Smith, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, and Assistant Secretary of Defense Celeste Wallander, saying all the same thing. Don't bomb oil refineries in Russia, because that will boost the oil price in the world. First of all, Russia should be bombed. That should be the aim of the war. Secondly, there's no evidence that this increases the oil price in the world. It hasn't happened, and it's not logical. And here it seems that the U.S. Is insisting on a no-fly zone over Russia, while it has persistently opposed a no-fly zone over Ukraine. And then you come to the big blow. Here, it turned out that the US, Britain, and France were perfectly able to take down more than 300 missiles and drones coming from Iran. And then they had done nothing for Ukraine. And President Zelensky, with the Ukrainian people, asked, what is this? Are you allies, or who are you?
So what's going on? Why is America, and this has been going on since Russia invaded Ukraine, it's always seemed like the U.S. doesn't really want Ukraine to win. They've delayed sending them the weapons, and they finally get them, and by which time the Russians have had plenty of time to build up their defenses, and now they're running out of ammunition. So what is their objective here? Why are they pretending to support Ukraine but doing it in a half-hearted way?
As far as I can understand, the U.S. administration doesn't know what it's doing. President Biden would be serious about winning the election, he would make sure that he wins the war against Russia in Ukraine. And he has expressed none of that. That is, President Biden himself said that in March 2022 that man, that is Putin, has to go. But then his staff walked him back on that, and he apparently accepted it. And after that, the U.S. has no aim in the war. It is as long as it takes, which we now know doesn't mean anything because they can't deliver the financing. And the Republicans here at the point, that is the Republicans that support Ukraine, they ask the Biden administration, say, what is your aim in the war in Ukraine? And the Biden administration has been unable to answer. So this is very embarrassing. What has happened in Europe, meanwhile, is that President Emmanuel Macron of France has taken the lead and say, we want Ukraine to win. We want Russia to be defeated, saying all the things that people like me would like to hear from the U.S. administration. And this is most of the countries in Europe that are saying it now. So Europe is taking a very different position than the U.S. The obvious reason is, of course, that much of Europe, including Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, feel seriously threatened by Russian aggression. And Washington says, oh, really? We haven't noticed that.
Well, I don't know that Ukraine can win against Russia, which has, what, four times the population and massive military-industrial complex. But on the other hand, Ukraine cannot lose, right? What's your definition of Ukraine winning?
My definition of Ukraine winning is that Ukraine takes or isolates Crimea so that Russia can't use it. Then Ukraine gets control over Black Sea shipping. And then I think that Putin will fall in one way or the other in mysterious ways that we cannot know about. And that's what I would define as winning. What is happening in Donbass, the eastern Ukraine, doesn't really matter. It has been quite stable there. The current Russian attacks on Kharkiv, the second biggest city in Ukraine, are quite serious. Ukraine needs to hold Kharkiv and cut off Crimea and continue the attacks in Russia on factories and oil refineries that the current U.S. administration opposes.
Right, but if the White House and Kamala Harris is telling Ukraine not to hit the Russian oil refineries, and Mike Johnson, and on orders from Trump, is holding up aid to Ukraine, are they going to be able to hold the line? I mean, at what point are the Europeans are going to step in enough? You say that Macron is trying to fill the gap, but it seems like this is a very urgent situation. And what I'm hearing in terms of the battlefront in Ukraine is that the Russians are making gains, and they're certainly making gains on destroying Ukraine's electrical infrastructure.
They are making some gains, but small gains. And I'm primarily looking up on the economic side of it. Ukraine needs $37 billion of money to cover the budget deficit this year. That is the financing from abroad. The European Union and the international organization can put up $30 billion. So here it's a whole of $7 billion at present from the US not participating. The EU can easily cover this. That is EU member countries. And what we are seeing now is that the smaller EU countries, European countries, leading donors outside of the Baltics and Poland are Denmark and Norway, that you wouldn't expect. And I would anticipate that Sweden and Finland that have strong fiscal finances, but they will come in much more. And I read in an opinion poll that one of the countries that supports Ukraine the most in Europe is Portugal. You wouldn't expect that. So it's really most of Europe rising. There are a few countries that are problematic. Hungary and Slovakia largely against. Austria totally confused, being very close to Russia traditionally, and Germany, having had a bad Russia policy for long, has not seen the light as yet. But France has. The UK is seeing a new role in its foreign policy after Brexit, dealing with Ukraine. So what I see is that Europe, by and large, with these exceptions, is coming together, while the EU is just getting lost.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Always my pleasure, Ian.
And again, I mean speak with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Stockholm Free World Forum, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It, and Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. And he has an article at the Kyiv Post, Ukraine Should Not Be Left to the Mercy of Devious U.S. Politicians. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing Biden's tax plan announced on Tax Day, which highlights the social values of America's middle class in contrast to the billionaires Trump helps out with his tax cuts, who pay lower rates than average folks. Sing it to them.
Just that bad. You get what you need. Oh, baby, yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Chuck Ma, the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 to 2004, he was an economic policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and senior advisor for budget policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton. He has a new report at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities for Tax Day, seven charts on the 2017 Trump's tax law and why Congress should set a new course. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Ma.
Oh, good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Chuck. And on Tax Day, President Biden spoke in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and made a pretty fiery speech contrasting himself with Donald Trump. And he said, I'll just read a bit of it, because Biden's not the easiest guy to listen to, frankly. Under my plan, nobody earning less than $400,000 will pay an additional penny. I hope you're all able to make $400,000. I never did, you know. I have to say, it's Trump's stock in Truth Social. His company drops any lower, he might do better under my tax plan than his. No billionaire should pay a lower tax rate than a teacher, a nurse, a sanitation worker. Folks, where we come from matters. When I look at the economy, I don't see it through the eyes of Mar-a-Lago. I see it through the eyes of Scranton. And that's not hyperbole. That's a fact. Donald Trump looks at the world differently than you and me. He wakes up in the morning in Mar-a-Lago thinking about himself. how he can help his billionaire friends gain power and control and force their extreme agenda on the rest of us. So is America listening?
Oh, I think it's maybe a little early, but I do think that they're, you know, from a just some a policy perspective, I think there's just going to be a very big debate this year into next, because in 2025, no matter who wins, right, whatever candidate wins, there's a huge tax policy decision to be made. There'll be trillions of dollars on the table. Every person in the country will be affected. So just from a substance perspective, it's extremely important. Yeah.
Well, but Trump had, I think Biden was referring to it, he had a bunch of billionaires come down to Mar-a-Lago a few days ago and spoke to them and promised them that if he's reelected, he will not only renew the 2017 tax cuts that you've written about, but he may even make them more generous to the 1% of the 1%. So how much is that at stake in this election for the billionaire class, America's plutocracy, given that the 2017 Trump tax cuts expire next year?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot at stake for, you know, for people across the board. And I think, you know, if you look back to the Trump tax cuts, I think at the time it was pretty clear that they were skewed very heavily in favor of very wealthy people and large corporations. And I think it was very clear at the time that it was very expensive, right? It was going to lose a couple trillion dollars. And I think those two things are very clear when it comes to the expiration, how we should go forward. But I think what's also become clear since it was enacted is how well it did, right? There were, the Trump administration made really very far-reaching and promises about what would happen. And what we see is a lot of those didn't happen, right? There was a specific promise made that if the corporate tax rate was cut, which it was really the centerpiece of the Trump tax cut, was cut from 35% to 21%, that would trickle down and help average workers. Now, as it turns out, that did not happen. That really all the money, the benefit of that flowed to shareholders who tend to be very wealthy and to executives and not to the rank and file workers who actually saw no overall, very, very good study showed no wage increase. So I think you have now this, you knew it was skewed in favor of wealthy people. You knew it was expensive, will continue to be expensive, but now you know it really failed to deliver. So that's why I think that really we do really need a course correction, right? We need to do something differently and focus on families, middle, lower income families, working class families, middle income families, and not on wealthy shareholders and higher income people.
So how different is Trump and his administration's justification for the 2017 tax cuts that went largely to the wealthy, the super wealthy, the billionaires and the corporations, selling it as that this will stimulate growth by taking the shackles off the billionaires? That's exactly what Ronald Reagan promised back in the 1980s.
There's definitely continuity. And this is the problem, right? I think it's been this way for, you know, right, exactly. See, President Reagan was the first, and then you had, again, George W. Bush, President Bush also, and then President Trump. So you had three major, right, supply-side trickle-down tax cuts, which basically promised if you cut taxes for very wealthy people, that somehow they do things and that the benefits trickle down to average people. And that's been just been shown over and over again to not be the case. And this is why we have to stop doing that, right? This is the point. And I think this is why this debate is so important, because there, you know, the country does face this choice next year about what to do with the tax code, right? And what, you know, where should the priorities be? And I would argue that the priority should be more on helping, right? Like we saw during the pandemic, reducing child poverty, right? Boosting the incomes of people who make $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and not reducing taxes for people who own our large corporations and actually making wealthy people. You know, in the U.S. right now, the wealthiest people in the country do not pay income taxes every year on much of their income like everybody else does.
Well, that is definitely the case, and I'm wondering whether there's sufficient outrage in the country to force the Congress to do something about it, because certainly the House is controlled by the Republicans and they have no interest in doing anything but helping out the billionaires. You got a Supreme Court, a couple of justices like to hang out with billionaires. That's their constituency, not the average American. So where's this pushback going to come from?
Well, I do think you see that asking, for corporations to pay a fair rate of tax, right, that they overreached and went too far. I think that wealthy people pay a more fair share of tax. If you look at the polls on those, you really see, pretty strong support from all the way across, from Republican to Democrats, independents. I mean, I think this is the problem with the Trump tax cut. One of the problems was that the top priority for the people who wrote the law was cutting the corporate tax rate. But I think for the people in the country, I don't think that was the top priority at all. I think that they wouldn't even have done that. And that was known at the time. And that's what's really was troubling, is that they, in effect, they knew that. And that's one reason they made that corporate tax rate cut permanent, right? We're talking about the expiration, right? A lot of Trump tax cuts expire. But the one thing that doesn't expire is the cut in the corporate tax rate, which I think is really important, given it, especially how it's failed, to put that back on the table.
So, is there anything that can be done in terms of tax legislation? Not that anything can be done unless, from Biden's point of view, unless he controls both the House and the Senate. And I don't know whether he need to pass the filibuster threshold. But aren't there certain things that could be done? For example, stopping what's happening with corporations. They pay less taxes, but they give bigger pay packages to their CEOs and they buy back more stock to drive the price of the stock up. And that's been happening. So instead of trickling down these breaks, trickling down to everybody in America, as Reagan has promised and Trump has promised, all they do is basically empower corporate CEOs and billionaires to make more money and to buy back their stock and to
Yeah, no,
run.
I do think the buyback is, it is something to see, that we really have seen buybacks increase sharply from after the 2017, the Trump tax cuts, to before, right? And next year, Goldman Sachs is projecting again that you're going to have about $1 trillion worth of buybacks. I mean, so that is, I just think is evidence that corporations are, flush with cash. Again, the corporate rate failed to deliver, they obviously can, they could pay higher taxes. And I think that the Trump tax cut was an overreach. I think they went too far. I think even the business lobbyists did not expect the corporate rate to get down to 21%.
So, what did Trump promise them at Mar-a-Lago recently in terms of not just extending his tax cuts, but making things better for them?
I don't know, and I haven't seen any, public proposals
Well,
coming out of.
what would you expect from him then, Chuck?
I don't know. I think there's a question of whether they even try to go deeper on the corporate tax rate. I think, yeah, there's always a question on high income, if they're going to have something new. But
Well,
again, I.
the odd thing is, though, that the deficit, which is what Republicans always cry about, that the sky is falling, and it's true, the deficit has just exploded. But it's exploded under Ronald Reagan originally, but then really exploded under Trump. I mean, in an amazing way. It's almost, I think, it more than doubled, didn't it?
Yeah, well, that's related to the pandemic. But I do think, if you look at, like, I think about the Bush tax cut and the Trump tax cuts, and they've basically eroded the revenue base of the country by about 3% of GDP, right? Which is equivalent to, like, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And I think, if you think about when the Bush tax cut was enacted, the baby boom was in the prime of their working lives. And now, post-Trump tax cut, the baby boom really is in the prime of their retirement years, right? And the United States has a will always have a very large military. So we have an elderly population, right? We still have very high child poverty. We have a lot of needs, housing needs, all kinds of needs. So the country just cannot afford to every few years to do one of these large tax cuts for high income people and then, just let the revenue base go down and down. So I think next year, with these expirations, you have a chance to recalibrate, right? To set a new course and to recoup some of that revenue. And again, with little risk of having any kind of downside, right? I think, again, since the corporate tax rate cut did not help workers, right? So I think it can be pretty safe that if the corporate rate is just increased even halfway back to where it was, we wouldn't expect to see much, negative outcome from that either. So,
But
decision.
just in closing, Chuck, the House Republicans are trying to cut the revenue that Biden was able to get in the IRA to help the Internal Revenue Service collect taxes from the super rich who have massive wealth protection industry lawyers and accountants. And I think there's $80 billion infused into the IRS to bring them up to speed
Oh yeah,
so
that
that they
was.
could.
Yeah, that was critical because for the 10 years before that, right, the IRS had been decimated, right? And you saw that the audit rates for millionaires went from, down by like 90%. I mean, it really devastated the IRS. You could also for average people, you couldn't get the IRS on the phone, right? So yeah, had services curtailed and far less enforcement of people, so make it easier for people to cheat on their taxes. So yeah, I agree with that completely.
But I'm saying that that's the agenda seems to be to continue
No, I agree.
not to take that money away.
Yes,
I
no, I agree
mean,
with that. And I think protecting that $80 billion and making it and replenishing that money and making it permanent is critical, right? Because again, it's not fair to honest taxpayers, right? That they can't call the IRS and get a question answered. They should be able to file their taxes for free and easily. And people who they should know that other people are paying their taxes too and not cheating.
Well, Chuck Meyer, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, great talk to you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I'll be speaking with Chuck Meyer, who's the Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 1999 to 2004, he was the Economic Policy Advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and a Senior Advisor for Budget Policy at the National Economic Council during the second term of President Clinton. And he has a new report at the Center on for Budget and Policy Priorities for Tax Day, 7 charts on the 2017 Trump tax law and why Congress should set a new course. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305.